Now on Sunday Extra, we're going to look at the conditions for workers on construction sites in Russia, but not just for any workers. A new report has revealed the plight of workers from North Korea who are sent to work in Russia by Kim Jong-un's regime. The report's called A Day in the Life of a DPRK State-Sponsored Labourer, and it's a report by Global Rights Compliance, an international law foundation based in The Hague. Yeji Kim is the DPRK, that's Democratic People's Republic of Korea, researcher for global compliance rights. And I'm very pleased to say that she joins us now on Sunday Extra. Welcome, Yeji.
Thank you so much for having me.
Your report profiles 21 North Koreans working on construction sites in three Russian cities. How many people does North Korea actually send to work overseas?
From our understanding, in Russia, anywhere between 40 to 45,000 workers are working in Russia at the moment. But globally, UN panel of experts reported there's anywhere between 90,000 to 100,000 workers are in 40 countries in the world.
Right. And what's the range of countries that they're working in? Because that's a very large number.
Yes. So the biggest two host country in the world at the moment are China and Russia. Mm-hmm. However, there's small amount of people are in Southeast Asian countries like Laos, Vietnam, and Thailand.
Now, as I said, you focused on North Koreans working on construction sites in Russia. Could you give us an overview of the working conditions that you found for these people?
So one worker told us that they lived like cattle, or even worse than a cattle, because cattle gets a rest day, but they do not. Workers we spoke to described waking up before 6 a.m. in unheated shipping containers, 20 men sleeping side to side, cockroaches, bed bugs, and no shower facilities. Some even said they only were allowed to take one or two showers per year, not week, month, or year. They work anywhere between 14 to 16 hours a day, and sometimes until midnight, regardless of weather. Russian winters with no protective equipment, no gloves, no heating on worksite. And after the mandatory state quota and deductions, they take home approximately $10 USD per month. They called it a cigarette money and survival money.
So $10 a month. That's after all these deductions. So what actually happens to the money these North Korean workers are earning? What's the top line amount that they're earning that then gets reduced down to this $10 a month?
Hiring North Korean workers are actually not that cheap compared to other migrant workers. So it is reported that they usually get around 800 USD per month from these Russian companies. However, we believe that between 600 to 700 USD, that's a huge chunk of what they're getting from the Russian companies, are going directly to the North Korean regime. And North Korea utilized this money to fund the regime itself, but most importantly, to fund their military aspirations, including ballistic missile and weapons of massive destructions.
So given the amount of money that's being skimmed off the top, it does actually translate into a significant amount of income for North Korea. Indeed, your report says that overseas state-sponsored labor as a program is a central pillar of the North Korean state's survival strategy.
UN Security Council Resolution 2375, adopted in September 2017, prohibited all member states from issuing new work authorization to North Korean nationals. And Resolution 2397, adopted 3 months later in December 2017, went further. It required all member states to repatriate every North Korean worker entered into their authorities within 24 months. And deadline was December 2019. And the resolution were adopted unanimously, including Russia, specifically because the Security Council drew a direct link between overseas labor revenue and the funding of North Korea's nuclear weapons and ballistic missile program. And the preamble of 2397 states this explicitly. However, our research confirms that deployments continued well into 2024 and are accelerating. And South Korea's National Intelligence Service reported last year that the number of North Koreans entering Russia in 2024 was 12 times higher than the previous year, with nearly 8,000 entering on student visa to circumvent this Security Council resolution. The resolution are clear on paper, but enforcement has been another matter entirely.
And it seems like the practice is on the rise from what you're saying. How does recruitment in the forced labor system work? Are these North Korean workers voluntarily going from their homeland to Russia?
Yes. So the North Korean regime recruit these people up and down the country, really selling this program as a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to go out, bring glory to the States, and make some money as well. So a lot of North Korean laborers do sign up for this opportunity with a deception and understanding that they can go out and earn some money. However, the reality they hit or they find is really drastically different from the expectation or what they've been sold. What is waiting for them is 16 hours of labor and identification confiscation, not being able to communicate to their family freely, and then just rigorous working hours up to 16 hours per day. So they do sign up for this program, but the gap between what they've been told and the reality is really, really different. And it's a classic forced labor indicator of deception.
On Sunday Extra, we're speaking with Yeji Kim, who's the North Korea researcher for Global Rights Compliance, which has compiled this report, A Day in the Life of a DPRK State-Sponsored Laborer. And of course, Yeji, North Korea is notorious, infamous for the level of control that it exercises over the North Korean population. But that's inside the closed borders of North Korea. How is control exerted and maintained on these workers once they leave the country?
Through overlapping systems that reinforce each other. First, document confiscation. Passports are taken on arrival, and every worker we spoke to confirmed this. Without a passport, you can't travel, change jobs, or access service. They systematically block the possibility of actually leaving the worksite. Secondly, the quota itself. Every North Korean laborers are demanded to given 600 to 700 USD per month to the States. And if you fail to fill that quota, it is not only you that face the problem, but your family act as a collateral back in North Korea also gets the ramification. And it functions as a debt bondage itself. You are always owing, always behind, always working to pay off what you owe. And that financial trap keeps you complacent. And thirdly, surveillance. This both vertical and horizontal surveillance are there outside. Political officers and team leaders monitor from above, but embedded informants among the workers themselves report from within. And everyone assumes that at least one person in their group is reporting back. One worker described keeping his face neutral at all times because he never knew who was watching. And lastly, I think collective punishment. If one person slows down, the entire group is punished with longer hours. This teaches the group to police itself. Finally, the families, workers with spouses, children, and elderly parents are deliberately prioritized for deployments because their families back home function as collateral. Everyone knows that defection or disobedience will bring consequences, not just for themselves, but for the people you left behind.
So given those overlapping and pernicious forms of control, does make me wonder, Yeji, how is it that you managed to be able to speak to these workers? How was it possible for them to be honest about what they were going through to your research team?
So GRC has a dedicated NoScript program that has built trusted relationship with civil society partners over time who are based in both Korea and Russia. And through our victim-led local partner who actually had this experience of forced labor in Russia, we were able to reach 21 North Korean nationals currently working on this construction site across 3 Russian cities. But we were also able to conduct separate interviews with 10 former forced laborers now resettled in South Korea. So we were able to reach to them through our dedicated local partner.
It really is a depressing and bleak portrait that you present of these workers' lives. You've referred to the UN Security Council resolutions, which are aimed at preventing practices like this. Clearly, they have not been effective. What, if anything, can be done, Yeji, to help these particularly vulnerable workers in particularly vulnerable circumstances?
I think the world needs to see the reality of how much harm North Korea is actually causing at the moment, because North Korea was able to get away with what they've been doing for over 7 decades, largely because from Western countries' point of view, North Korea is just a hermit kingdom in the Far East that doesn't affect the real world. But the reality is North Korea is now more than ever affecting the world by sourcing weapons to Hamas and Iran, sending troops to Russia. I think not caring about what North Korea regime is doing is exactly what they want, and we cannot let it happen. So we need to start looking this forced labor issue more than just a human rights violation, but the global supply chain issue. In 2026, if goods tainted by modern slavery, forced labor is landing on the shore of Australia, I think Australian general public very much would like to know. And it's a supply chain problem and sanctions compliance problem and a human rights crisis at all at once. So we need to identify who is financially benefiting from this program aside from North Korea and seek accountability. When we ask the workers what they want in terms of accountability and what they really want to convey to the international community, they did not ask for something impossible. They asked for safety equipment, they asked for reduced working hours, and the ability to call their families. And I believe these are achievable goals for the member state to really push accountable actors. And the question is whether anyone is willing to act.
Yeji Kim, thank you so much for joining us on Sunday Extra.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Yeji is the DPRK Researcher for Global Rights Compliance, whose new report is A Day in the Life of a DPRK State-Sponsored Labourer.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.